Welcome to the Future of Pharma with ISP Boston, where I talk to the thought leaders of the pharmaceutical industry about where our industry is headed and what you can do about it. I'm your host, Samir Gondalia. Thanks for joining us today.
My guest today is Professor Charles Cooney. Professor Cooney received his bachelor's in chemical engineering from the University of Pennsylvania in 1966 and his SM in 1967 and PhD in 1970 in biochemical engineering from MIT. He joined the MIT faculty as an assistant professor in 1970, becoming full professor in 1982. Professor Cooney's honors include the 1989 Gold Medal of the Institute of Biotechnological Studies, London, the Food, Pharmaceutical, and Bioengineering Award from the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, the James Van Lennon Distinguished Service Award from the American Chemical Society's Division of Microbial and Biochemical Technology, an election to the American Institute of Medical and Biochemical Engineers, and the Fellows of the American Chemical Society. A consultant to multiple biotech and pharmaceutical companies, Professor Cooney has served on the boards of Genzyme, Polypore International, and Biocon Limited India, among others. His research and teaching span many aspects of the biochemical engineering and pharmaceutical manufacturing. He holds more than 30 patents, has published over 250 research papers, and has co-authored or edited 5 books, including Development of Sustainable Bioprocesses, Modeling and Assessment. In addition to his professional interests, Professor Cooney is a trustee of the Boston Ballet, an overseer of the London Symphony Orchestra, and a board member of MIT's Community Service Fund. Other interests include rock climbing, skiing, high altitude mountaineering, scuba diving, and antique map collecting. Professor Cooney is a man of many talents and interests, and in this interview, we explore and talk about almost all of them and much more. Here's Professor Cooney with his thoughts on the future of the pharmaceutical industry.
Good morning, Professor Cooney. Thank you for joining us on this show. How are you doing today?
Well, thank you.
So let's first begin at the beginning. Tell us about your foray into the earliest phase of biotechnology development in the 80s, you know, the swinging 80s in Cambridge, and lessons learned from that technological revolution in the healthcare industry. I understand you were one of the earlier advisors with Genentech and Genzyme. So please give us a brief history lesson of biotech in the 80s and the earliest development.
Well, indeed, the 1980s were a very exciting time with the evolution of a completely new industry. But I think to understand a couple of my thoughts as I reflect back on those days, I like to go back to 1970 when I was when I did a short postdoc at what was
70s.
Then Squibb. Yes, and in the 1970s, that was an era of antibiotics and amino acids, and a lot of work was being done in developing the fundamental technology that we take for granted as being quite routine in biotechnology today. But at that time, I had the opportunity to spend time at Squibb as a postdoc doing research in industrial scale reactors. These were 40 cubic meter reactors making penicillin. Squibb had about 20 of them. And I learned some very important lessons
in those early days. Was that the remnants of the World War II? Because I think the industrial scale bioreactors and penicillin, that sounds a lot like what we developed during World War II.
Yes, it was. Those reactors, the oldest reactors, were for manufacturing citric acid and were even larger. Mm-hmm. And had been built in what was an old shipbuilding site. The penicillin reactors were slightly post-World War II and were one of the major manufacturing facilities for penicillin in the world. With the opportunity to work on penicillin manufacturing at scale, at 40 cubic meter scale, there were three lessons that I felt laid the groundwork for me preparing for entry into what we now know as biotechnology. The first was a realization that manufacturing is on the critical path between delivering the science of discovery and drug development and the patient. If you didn't get manufacturing right, you didn't have a product and you didn't have the impact on the patient.
Right.
Second, I learned that scaling is hard. Scale up in large reactors, it was actually very difficult to implement. And one of the major reasons was that the quality of sensors and the availability of sensors that we had to monitor the biological activity in the reactor were quite limited. We could measure temperature, pH, pressure, dissolved oxygen, but not much more. And as a consequence, our ability to understand the basic physiology of the organism was really quite limited. So that connectivity between what we could measure and what the organism wanted to respond to was a major limitation in scale up. And that was a lesson that was important to learn early in my career. And the third is one day while installing dissolved oxygen probes inside the reactor, standing on top of one of the impellers, I looked around at the cooling coils, the impellers, the probes that were in the reactor, and I had this realization that this is what it's like to be a microorganism. And I learned the lesson to think like a microorganism at that very moment. And again, that is a lesson that has held me in good stead over the years. And then going to the 1980s, I had the opportunity to be involved with Genentech as a consultant from January of 1980. I spent over 10 years as a consultant working with Genentech to design the new processes for manufacturing recombinant proteins. This had never been done before.
Right.
Now, to realize that, in 1980, early 1980, Genentech had 30 employees in the company.
Yeah, it was a startup.
And it was a startup, and no one had manufactured recombinant proteins, let alone scaled them to commercial scale before. So this was a very exciting opportunity as a young academic to be deeply involved in that earliest stages, the scale up, earliest stages of the design, the scale up, the implementation of processes for making new recombinant proteins. And as I reflect on those early years at working with Genentech, I'd say there are three things that I took away from that. I realized that a scaling of these processes to commercial scale was really a new science. It had moved from art monitoring a few parameters to literally the science of a process design and development. The second lesson was the critical role of the regulators, that we were bringing new products that had not been made before forward for use in human therapeutics. The regulators didn't have prior experience either in regulating these products.
Right. So they were learning at the same time as you were.
They were learning at the same time. And this was, in a way, a collaboration between the industry and between the regulators to figure out what needed to be monitored, needed to be understood in order to make safe and efficacious products for human use. And that relationship with the regulators was not an adversarial relationship. It was a partnership that had the end result of improving human lives. And the third lesson was the criticality of analytics, that your ability to measure not only how well the process was doing, but measure the characteristics of the product so that you knew that you were making the same efficacious product day in and day out. And that understanding of analytics, for me, was a very important lesson to be carried forward for the next, as I reflect now, the next 40 years.
Right.
You mentioned Genzyme as well. And I had the privilege of being involved in the very early days with a group of my colleagues in the founding years of Genzyme and putting the company together. And as I reflect on that experience, it was in many ways parallel with my learnings from Genentech, but it was also quite different. Genzyme was being built as a different kind of company, not mm-hmm. simply built around the core technology of recombinant proteins as a platform. But the lessons I learned from Genzyme were that it was built around a different business model. We had identified rare diseases as an opportunity, as an unmet medical need. Hmm. And one of the founders of Genzyme had developed the ability to isolate the enzyme glucocerebrosidase mm-hmm. from human placenta.
Okay.
And to purify it. And we began doing clinical trials to demonstrate its safety and efficacy in patients with Gaucher's disease. And the innovation, interestingly, was not just in the science and the technology, but was also in learning how to build a business around making a therapeutic product that would service a small number of patients around the globe and to get reimbursed for it.
Right, right.
So the innovation was around the business model.
And right now, so we can say Genzyme was one of the pioneers of this business model, because right now there is a whole industry of startup biotech companies in Cambridge itself that we are aware of. They are specifically working on rare diseases to meet the unmet needs of a very small segment of population of patients, which is not getting treated as of now. You were also on the board of Genentech and Genzyme for a while, right?
Well, I was a consultant at Genentech, and I was on the board of Genzyme for 30 years until we sold it to Sanofi.
Right.
And your observation about the common business model of making products for unmet medical needs in these rare diseases is in fact a very frequently used business model today. But to reflect back on the early 1980s, we were ridiculed by Big Pharma as how could you build a viable business around making therapeutic products for some thousands or tens of thousands of patients. So it was a very interesting time. And a second lesson I learned from that experience was the criticality of alignment of not only supplying a drug product for the patient, but integrating that entire manufacturing and distribution supply chain with patient information. And integrating and aligning that with reimbursement. Mm. So in fact, as biochemical engineers, we need to think about three supply chains simultaneously. The supply of drug product, mm-hmm. the supply and management of information around that drug product, and the ability to be reimbursed and pay for all the work that has been done, both in development and manufacturing of that product. And I think we too often forget that we have to align these three independent supply chains.
Right, right. Well, we are not going to forget the last one about getting the reimbursement for all the work for many years that has gone into developing the new drugs and getting reimbursed for it. It's been in news a lot lately. So that lesson hasn't changed. I do have one question about the 80s. What are your thoughts on what we thought we could do in the 80s with this technology? And so promises versus delivery. What did we think we could do? And what did we actually end up getting out of biotechnology? Because as you mentioned, it was very, very exciting. And when you have something new, you think you are going to change the world. In a way, it did. But where do we stand between what we thought it could deliver and what it actually delivered over, say, 40 years?
Well, in those early years, there was a tremendous amount of excitement about the vision of making human proteins in bacteria and then eventually animal cells, specifically CHO cells. I think we all had the vision that we were going to be able to make any human therapeutic protein and deliver it as a therapeutic, and that this was the beginning of a very exciting era, not only in what we call biotechnology, but in the pharmaceutical industry and human healthcare, and animal healthcare as well. Then there were several things that began to emerge as reality. One is that it took longer to develop some of these products than we wished it would take. And certainly the investment community was very impatient. They thought we could deliver these products to human health faster than one actually could. And of course, one of the barriers was one that I spoke to earlier, and that is learning how to regulate the safety and efficacy of these products.
Could it be also I just have one quick question. Could it be also because the investment community and the society at large, they were more used to the little faster development of small molecules, and they were comparing biotech products with those?
I think that's true. Okay. I do think that's true. Small molecules were easier to define and characterize. And it actually comes back to one of the early lessons I learned, and that is the criticality of the analytics.
Yeah.
These large molecules are difficult to not only make, but even more difficult to characterize with the same precision that we can chemically define small molecules.
Yeah, and they are so unpredictable. By the way, I do apologize to keep interrupting you, but I don't want to lose that thread, and I do want to get, I think our listeners will have the same questions as I'm asking, so I'm sorry about keep interrupting you.
Quite all right.
Yeah, please go ahead. So we are talking about challenges of longer investment time, and you are going to make your second point.
Yes, the second point is we were learning to make larger and more complicated molecules. They were complicated because not only of the size, but because post-translational modification, particularly glycosylation, was a factor. And in some cases, they were multimers, antibodies being a very important example, where you have four polypeptide chains that are bound together and heavily modified with post-translational modification. And these were more difficult to make. They took more time to develop, and we didn't know in the early days how to analyze and characterize them. We were having to learn that simultaneously with learning how to make them and how to regulate them and what constituted a safe and efficacious product.
So all the lessons from, say, development, working with the regulators, excitement versus the reality, if we look at all the lessons from the 80s, and if you look at the current innovation landscape, a lot of new modalities have come along in the last 5 years. They have become mainstream. How do the lessons from 80s apply to current landscape? How can we learn from those and do it better or avoid the same mistakes that we made in the early phase of biotech development?
In the early part of our conversation, you mentioned the very exciting early days of biotechnology in the 80s.
Yeah.
And as I look at the development of what we frequently call the new modalities, that include gene therapy, cell therapy, RNA, and the like, this is also an unbelievably exciting time in biotechnology.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's like going back to those early, for me, it's like going back to those early days and asking the very question that you just did. And that is, well, what have we learned, that will help us do this product development, process development better than we did before? First of all, process science has matured dramatically. It's matured particularly with the capability, the analytical capability of characterizing these complex products. We're not where we need to be, but we're making good progress. We also learned what I think are three important strategies from those early days of biotechnology that hold us in good stead for going forward. One is intensification. We learn to improve the process by getting higher titers, by working faster, by intensification both of process development as well as manufacturing itself.
Right.
Second, we learned how to integrate the different steps in the process, whether it be inoculum development and those early stages of developing the culture for manufacturing, and integration of the upstream with the downstream.
Are you talking about continuous manufacturing?
Well, continuous manufacturing is an interesting manifestation of intensification and integration. The third important lesson coming forward is interrogation. We learned how to better monitor, and we are learning how to better monitor and measure what's important, the critical process parameters. You mentioned continuous manufacturing.
Right.
I had an opportunity last fall to give a keynote address at a continuous manufacturing conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I had volunteered to try and create a framework around how we think about continuous manufacturing. And by the time that I was prepared to give the talk, I had learned three important lessons. One is, it's not about continuous manufacturing. It's about process intensification and integration, of which continuous manufacturing is simply one way that we can achieve those goals.
Mm.
Second, it doesn't make sense to develop any process improvement unless there's a good business model for it. Management has to approve the budget to develop the new process science, the new manufacturing technology, and they're not going to do that unless there's a good business case, because that technology addresses a need not only of the industry but of the patient. And the third was, again, this important critical issue of getting the analytics right. The analytics to establish product similarity, product comparability by whatever process you use is absolutely essential. And I look at analytics as the vocabulary with which we communicate with the regulators, and the guidelines of the regulators are the grammar with which we put that vocabulary into a coherent communication.
Right. And also we need all the real-time analytical data. In biologics, we are used to taking a sample and waiting for 5 days till you get the results back. But continuous manufacturing, you don't have that luxury. You run it, and at some point, if your end product doesn't meet the analytical criteria, then the whole effort is not useful, because the end product is not usable. And you can't make any changes in continuous manufacturing because you're not getting real-time data. But I think with PAT, we are seeing some improvement. I had, by the way, a very interesting conversation about continuous manufacturing and other things with one of your colleagues, Professor Bernard Trout. It's in one of the previous episodes of the podcast. But yes, we are going back to the new modalities. And I do want to know, with all the excitement, the new modalities, cell therapy, gene therapy, CRISPR, RNA, they have been around for a while, at least in the development phase, right? They are not brand new. But in last 5 years, they have become mainstream with all the interest from the VC community and patients and the pharma companies. What are the promises of this thing? And how do you think it will change our industry, or which segment of our industry, pharma industry, or healthcare, it will affect?
Well, you're asking an important but complex set of questions. You're right. Many of these modalities have been around for a long time. And one of the early lessons I learned at Genzyme, as we thought about developing the business of biotechnology and being innovative in that business, we began doing cell therapy over 25 years ago, gene therapy efforts were initiated at Genzyme over 25 years ago.
Right.
We implemented very large scale continuous manufacturing for Sevelamer, a polymer used to capture phosphate in dialysis patients. And we were manufacturing at very large scale in multiple plants on a continuous basis, this large, high molecular weight a polymer. So a lot of these lessons that we're building upon, they're not new. But what is new and what is very exciting is that, one, we're learning how gene therapy, cell therapy, gene editing, RNA therapies, phage therapies, how they can address unmet medical needs. And it goes back to the business case, and the business case is all about the patient and about the patient experience. And there's no sense developing a process to make a product if it isn't going to benefit the patient. And that's the excitement. The challenge we have as biochemical engineers is to develop the process technology. And of course, that process technology to manufacture these products rests on the shoulders of those who have been before us, learning to intensify biological reactions, integrate the synthesis with the downstream recovery, interrogate the process with sophisticated analytics, and to work with the regulators to assure that we have a safe and efficacious product.
Right.
So this is in one way a continuum of what we have learned in biological manufacturing from the past. In another way, it's a new frontier of making very complex products that are not individual molecules, but are complex viruses, complex cells, complex molecules that we're getting better at designing through protein manipulation, through improved and design post-translational modification. Very, very exciting time.
How are we going to pay for it as a society? Because the science behind it is making these products a lot more expensive than their counterparts. But mostly, I think for the most part, we have figured out how we are going to pay for it, with the exception here and there. You are currently on board of quite a few companies. You are still active, Kodiak, Greenlight Biosciences. Tell us why. What is so exciting happening at these companies that makes you still be affiliated with them, and how it can potentially disrupt what's happening right now? What makes, you know, the companies you are affiliated with, Kodiak and Greenlight Bioscience, for example, different than others? And what's so exciting about the science at these companies?
Well, again, I go back to a point that you made a moment ago, and that is around the excitement of these new modalities, which are based upon a disruptive science. So through deep science and understanding, we have begun to realize that not only can we make products that will address human needs, but also agricultural needs as well. Let me take Kodiak as an example. This is a company which was formed around the ability to make exosomes. These are microvesicles secreted by all cells, not just animal cells, but all cells. These microvesicles, on the order of 100, 120 nanometers, contain proteins, nucleic acids, and represent a vehicle for delivery of many different therapeutics. For instance, delivery of RNA, or delivery of proteins, or delivery of genes. And the vision that is in place here is the ability to take these microvesicles, which are normally produced by actively growing cells, be able to manufacture them with the precision that we have learned to manufacture protein biologics, and develop them as human therapeutics. So again, it's, as a biochemical engineer, it's an opportunity to learn how to develop the processes, scale them, and manufacture these complex microvesicles in a way that makes them safe and efficacious for the patient. So it's exciting. It's an exciting opportunity to make new therapeutic products to address unmet medical needs and to have to develop the process technology that hadn't been done before. You know, the early analytical methods investigating microvesicles was based on laboratory techniques, not what we know today as modern bioprocessing. But this is a route that we're able to take. So it's very exciting. And another and very different example is Greenlight Bioscience. This is a company that was founded on early technology developed by Jim Schwartz at Stanford, and whom I proudly acknowledge as a former student of mine and also was a long time and early employee at Genentech. So he was very involved in the earliest stages of developing bioprocessing. And I remember in the early days of working with him at Genentech, he had this vision that why couldn't you use cell extracts in a cell-free system? And then over the subsequent decades, he developed this technology, and he was one of the founders of Greenlight Bioscience. At Greenlight, we then began using cell-free synthesis for making a wide variety of interesting molecules, but more recently realized that this was a fantastic platform for making RNA. And in fact, we had the opportunity to manufacture RNA in cell-free systems with a very low-cost process to make RNA available for agricultural use, where the cost pressures are much more severe than for human therapeutic use.
Oh.
So I think, you know, it's another example as biochemical engineers, how we have been able to take fundamental cellular processes, rethink the question, why can't we take fractions of cellular systems and use them effectively to make high purity products for human or animal or agricultural use. So it's that nexus of making products that will have impact and then being able to engineer the biological system through process design, process science, and scale up into manufacturing. Once again, these new modalities will have high impact on human health and agriculture.
Absolutely. So at Kodiak, if I understand it correctly, exosomes is actually a type of vehicle that can deliver different modalities rather than working on one modality. Did I understand it correctly? Because that sounded very interesting.
Absolutely. The microvesicles, the exosomes, are a platform for addressing multiple needs.
Oh, that is fantastic. So it's actually developing a tool. So instead of one thing, you can use it to different modalities. I can clearly see why it would be very, very exciting. Now, when you and I were talking, you mentioned something very interesting about the external, non-scientific, non-technical factors, such as foreign policy and social trends, how they can affect the healthcare and vice versa. Can you share your thoughts on that?
Yes. One of the lessons I began to learn early in my career is that we don't work in isolation in the laboratory. Whatever we do, if we want to deliver impact, we have to understand the larger global context for the science, for the technology, and what's going to enable it and what's going to constrain it. And one of the early lessons I learned was that we work in a imprecise and uncertain world. And it's not just around the science and technology. For instance, I became involved in the development of early days of biotech and process development in India. Over the last 30 years, I have had a regular commute to work, particularly with multiple companies in India. Initially, Astra, before it became AstraZeneca, and then later in the early days of Biocon.
Yeah.
And it was a very important part of my education, of learning how to develop technologies and bring them to the commercial marketplace in a very different economic and social and political environment. So that paying attention to the evolution of regulatory policy, the evolution and dynamics and tensions of trade, the evolution and sophistication of intellectual property in different parts of the world,
right,
and how you manage it. So that I try to tell my students and convey to my students that if you want to really have impact in the world, you need to think about how do you manage your science, your products, your markets in over 100 countries that are all different. And these are not just markets, but they're sources of innovation. When you look at the population of the world, in India with over a billion people, China, over a billion people. In Southeast Asia, over a billion people. There are a lot of very smart people doing really good things, and innovation happens everywhere. So you need to understand the fact that we are a global community, foreign policy, whether it be trade, regulatory, intellectual property, innovative science, markets, social, cultural issues. These are so critical to the development of successful products and to realize the impact that we all aspire to have. When I was first in the early days, well, you talk about the early days of 1980s, I had the opportunity to travel in China during 1980 through 1985 when China was just beginning to open up.
Right.
And yes, they were practicing the manufacturing of antibiotics and a few other pharmaceutical products by fermentation, but they, coming out of the Cultural Revolution, had no idea how to develop or market or even begin to think about the supply and distribution and reimbursement of biotech products for human use. Today, China is the number two pharmaceutical market in the world.
And to your point about foreign policy in healthcare, one thing that is heartening is that in all this political turmoil going around the world, all these years, not just now, but all these years, they have kept the healthcare off the table. So that is like in a cocoon of its own, where the patient's well-being is not threatened by other geopolitical forces. So it does have impact, at least in a way that it's been kept off the table, and patients can still get the healthcare benefits from the products from other countries, no matter what else is going on around the world. You don't usually use the words like professor and ballet in the same sentence, so which makes me very excited to ask you the next question. You have been affiliated with Boston Ballet, Boston Symphony Orchestra, Boston Public Library. Tell us, what did you discover and learn from pursuing those passions, and how did you end up being affiliated with these organizations?
Well, I have to confess that I neither play a musical instrument, nor do I dance.
I was going to ask, was there an audition? But I wasn't sure.
There are two things that have drawn me to the arts world. One is the realization that in art, whether it be in music, in dance, in my interest in cartography, and these are professions that bring a lot of pleasure that bring a lot of pleasure to us. I saw my first ballet in 1975 in Moscow at the Bolshoi Theater, when the Bolshoi did Swan Lake. And I had never seen ballet before. I was a young academic. And I fell in love with the art form. I had long been interested in classical music. And I realized that these activities are really very similar to what we do in science and engineering. Mm-hmm. It's bringing together skills, and it's in the excellence of how you bring that together and and deliver a performance in the case of a symphony or in the case of a ballet to the audience. So, for instance, if you think about music, orchestration, why is it when you look at the people on the stage of a symphonic orchestra, you may have over 100 musicians from almost as many nationalities? They're certainly not, they have not grown up in the same culture. They have not grown up playing the same instrument, and they have not grown up speaking the same language. Yet the ability to implement the orchestration is enabled by a common vocabulary and language in music.
Yeah.
And isn't that exactly what we do in biotechnology?
Yes.
We're using our analytics as a common vocabulary in order to bring together process design and development and execution, whether it be a recombinant protein or a gene vector for a virus vector for gene therapy, or a cell, as in CAR T therapy. Mm-hmm. It's in the orchestration of what we do. So I've learned a lot by being on the board of the Boston Symphony and in the Boston Ballet. When you look at dance, the choreography is at the core. That's your process design, but it's the integration of dance, mm-hmm. music, light, stage, costumes. It's that integration that we do all the time in process design, in process development and manufacturing. And here, dancers are learning to do it in the same, you know, in an analogous way. Mm. And I sit there and I look at these performances and I'm just inspired to do what I do, what you do, what we all do a bit better.
Right.
And then I developed an early interest in cartography, old maps, and particularly 15th, 16th century cartography. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with these maps because when I looked at them, I realized that they were, one, they were beautiful, mm-hmm. But two, they're wrong. They're just wrong. Uh-huh. And it's not because the early cartographers made them wrong on purpose. It's because they represent the state of knowledge at the time. So every time I pick up and I hold one of these 500-year-old manuscript maps, it makes me very humble, mm-hmm. because I realize that, yes, the papers we publish today, we absolutely believe that they're correct and the best that they could be, and they are. Mm. But then new knowledge will show that our knowledge was imperfect. Just like new knowledge allowed these history, you look at the history of maps, they evolve and they get more precise with time. So, to me, they represent the ultimate in understanding imprecision, uncertainty, and incorrect information. And maps provide a framework for learning, just like our process flow diagram is the map for the products that we want to make. So these areas of the arts are an opportunity for us to learn and to step back and be objective and to think holistically about how others are able to achieve excellence and perfection in what they do. And I find the lessons learned from this and applied to my passion of manufacturing are quite useful.
What you said about the maps being wrong and the people of the time absolutely believed them to be 100% accurate and they charted their journeys according to the maps, that is so true. I read a book, that is a really good book by Nassim Taleb called The Black Swan. And the whole premise of the book, you read the book, right? And I found the book is really good, but I found the first few pages so interesting, where for centuries, collectively, as human species, we believe that there is no such thing as black swan until they found one in Australia. And suddenly the whole belief system changed. And it just shows you the fallacy of believing into something based on limited knowledge. And as a scientist, as you know, biochemical engineer, where we in pharma industry, in healthcare, we constantly try to explore and even push the boundaries. It really helps being open-minded and open to possibilities. What if I'm wrong? You know, that can teach us so many things. So that was a really good lesson. You are also an avid outdoorsman. What lessons can we learn from things that say rock climbing and risk management while rock climbing? Our pharma industry is a very risky industry. Anything we can extrapolate from those outdoor activities?
Well, before I answer that question, I have to go back to your example of the black swan. Mm-hmm. And the black swan is a central theme within the ballet Swan Lake.
Yes, yes.
So you're absolutely right. It's a very important metaphor that we should pay increasing attention to. Yes, I do have an interest in mountaineering and whether it be rock climbing, ice climbing, high altitude mountaineering. It's just a spectacular environment. And again, I find it's an opportunity to take your mind to a new place and think in a very focused way about the problem that you want to solve, and solving the moves on a complicated rock climb are not all that different than solving the moves we need to make in developing a process for a new modality. Rock climbing, what I really enjoy is high altitude mountaineering, above 18,000 feet. It's just a beautiful environment. And I've learned, I guess, three lessons that have held me in good stead, both in rock climbing and in bioprocess development. One is risk management. When you're going up a complicated rock face or you're climbing at high altitude in snow and ice, there is a risk. Yeah. And, you know, a fall hurts. In yes. fact, until you take a fall, you don't feel confident. So, in order to build that confidence, you have to realize you're going to make mistakes, and that if you aggressively plan for a fall, that when that mistake does happen, it's not going to be disastrous. It's going to hurt, just like when we did the assay wrong or we had a contaminated batch.
Yeah.
So the risk management, dealing with uncertainty, is a very important lesson. Second, to focus. Focus on what you're doing. You have to do it right. When you make a step on a rock face, you have to commit. And that commitment sometimes is very scary. When you inoculate that new batch, or when you put that expensive material onto a new chromatographic column, you need to focus on doing it right, because, you know, you're committing important resources.
Right.
And then third, it's holistic thinking. That people often ask me, I mean, why are you driven to summit these mountains? And I've had, with my sons who are my climbing partners, I've had the opportunity to climb a number of big mountains, Denali in Alaska, Amadablam in Nepal, Waskaran down in the Andes. And it's, if you think about summiting, you're making a very big mistake. You have to think holistically. What is your goal? And your goal is to get back down. You have an aspiration. You have an aspiration that it would be really, really cool to be able to summit that peak. But you make your decisions based on your goal, not your aspiration. Mm. And that was a very important lesson for me that I learned from mountaineering, that even if you summit, you're only 25% into the journey, because 75% of the accidents happen on the way down. We saw this play out just this year, just this spring, with a number of tragic accidents on Mount Everest. Most of those people who died, they were on their way down, not yes. their way up. And just like in what's the goal in manufacturing? It's the delivery of a safe and efficacious product to the patient. It's not a successful batch. And we, you know, the aspiration is to have a high performing process, or to bring in new technology, continuous manufacturing, or to develop a process for a new modality. But that's the aspiration. That's the aspiration. The goal is to deliver a safe and efficacious product consistently, day in, day out, for the patient. Getting those issues right is, for me, an important part of a lesson I learned in mountaineering.
The thing you said about our goal should be to deliver safe and efficacious product, that is so true, because in our industry, the pharma industry, we spend a lot more money, energy, and resources in failed clinical batches than failed manufacturing batches. We can make anything, right? We can get the manufacturing right, we can make the medicine, but they fail in clinical, and if they fail in clinical, then they are not good to patients and society. About the difference between goal and aspirations, that was a really good point. My next question can be an episode into itself. What are the books that you are influenced by and the books you recommend to your students? Outside of engineering, by the way.
Yes, we all do extensive reading of books and journals and in our scientific discipline. I like history. I'm particularly interested in the period of discovery,
Renaissance, in the
Renaissance period and the following centuries. In which the explorers got themselves outside of Europe and Asia. I would just to give you three examples. Of course, given my interest in maps, it wouldn't surprise you that I've read multiple times the diaries of Christopher Columbus. I find it very interesting reading his diaries from his four journeys to what we now know as North America. Yeah. And it's important to realize that I believe that when Columbus died after his four voyages, he did not realize that the land mass that he bumped into was not China.
Oh, okay.
He set out to develop a new trade route to India.
Right, right.
And he put forward the business proposition to Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand that he could deliver on that promise. And in fact, he failed. Right. He was successful, of course, in discovering North America. But even when he died, I don't believe that he knew that it was a new continent. That represents, you know, the uncertainty with which we today experiment with processing for new therapeutic modalities. We're in those early days. So I find the lessons of Columbus and that period of history to be fascinating. And it's the foundation on which we understand much of the world today. And I'm actually very interested in that. And I've read a lot about not only Columbus, but Vasco da Gama. Mm-hmm. And I'm very interested in the question, why Vasco da Gama succeeded where Columbus failed.
Yeah, he actually found India. He actually discovered India.
He did. Yeah. And it's an interesting comparison as you look at those two sailors and how one was successful and one was not.
Right.
So I you know, that period of time I find just rich in lessons. Coming forward, a book I recommend to all my students is The Jungle by Upton Sinclair.
Oh, yes.
I think
yes.
It was 1910. And it was an interesting investigative reporting on the meatpacking industry. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the lessons learned from that book led to the founding of the FDA, know as the FDA today.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, understanding how history sets the stage for where we are today is, to me, very important to understand. And maybe the third example is what I'm reading right now. I'm reading Chernow's biography of Alexander Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit of an intimidating read because of the length of the book and the detail with which Chernow has written about Hamilton. But it is such a well-written book that it takes you into that period of the American Revolution, the period preceding the revolution itself, and the early stages of the development of our government. And it's been eye-opening. I had, of course, you know, like so many have studied American history in a simplistic manner. And this is a deep dive into, well, who were the people? What were the dynamics? What were the events that shaped the form of the government that we live in today? And it's an absolutely fascinating read. And again, I find the lessons learned from those early stage dynamics set the stage for what we're seeing play out politically, culturally, socially in the world today. So a fascinating read. We are not in a new place. We are in history, but we're in a new, we are in a new place in history, but it is based upon where we came from. It's not based upon only new discovery.
Right. No, absolutely. The thing you said about Hamilton and that era, that is so interesting, because one recommendation I got from one of the interviews I listened to was, if you want to learn about a particular era, read biographies of different people from that era, because you will get the different take of the same event and you can get different perspective. So you will get it. It will be more accurate of the whole era rather than from one point of view. So say if you read George Washington's biography, you read about him. But if you read Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Hamilton, and all those, John Adams, Hancock, and all those people, you can see how different perspective played out in that era. So and you just reiterated that. What would be the easiest way to get in touch with you if someone wants to, after listening to this interview, if someone wants to get in touch with you?
Well, my email has been invariant since the first days of inventing email.
Okay. That's how I found you, by the way.
Yes, ccooney@mit.edu.
So I was talking to Professor Trout and Professor Webster of Northeastern University, and they also said the same thing. We are professors. We can't hide. Just Google us. Professor Cooney, before we say goodbye, do you have any ask or any parting words to our listeners?
There are four things that have been important to me and that I try to lead with my students. And these are four principles that I operate with. First is learn to listen. It's more difficult to listen than it is to speak. And listening to others is the most important thing that you can do, whether it's through your reading, whether it's through your conversations, but listen. Second is create options. That there's not, plan A doesn't always work. Right. And whether it be in your career or in your process or in your products or in your life, you want to always have those options that you can choose from. And when you have options, you're in control, whether it be manufacturing or in your life. Third, embrace diversity. That we are all limited by our prior knowledge. We know what we know. We know what we've experienced. And by embracing diversity in its broadest sense, scientific, cultural, social, you're able to learn so much more and much better understand what it is you want to do. And lastly, mind the gap. That most problems happen at interfaces. And we tend to focus our intellectual and a lot of our thinking in a silo. And the world does not operate in silos. Mind the gap. Focus on not just the problem at hand, but what's around it and what's the interface between it.
Well, Professor Cooney, thank you so very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. My pleasure to speak with you.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Be sure to subscribe and let others know. Word of mouth is our oxygen. Visit www.ispeboston.org for the comprehensive show notes from today's episode and also find out more ways to associate with us. Do let us know your thoughts in the comment section, and if there is someone you'd like to see as a guest on this show, thanks again for joining us today. We'll see you next time.